Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoek.
It's Tuesday, April 23rd from HBR2. It's The Conversation. Legally Bound. A labor saver sticks new owners with old staff.
Culture clashing women report conflict.
Pratfalling into Hollywood arms.
And hard questions about saving other lives as one life ends.
Al Jazeera has today's world report. We've got a penguin in the backyard and bills and budgets in the reality check. Now the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The 19-year-old bombing suspect under armed guard at a Boston-area hospital is now reported to be in fair condition. It's still uncertain if Johar Tsarnaev is able to speak due to a gunshot wound to the neck. Yesterday, he was answering authorities' questions in writing. Tsarnaev faces multiple charges linked to last Monday's bombing and the shooting death of an MIT police officer days later. The administration says Tsarnaev, a naturalized U.S. citizen, will not be tried as an enemy combatant. More details are emerging about Tsarnaev's alleged co-conspirator, his older brother Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He was killed in a firefight with police last week. Investigators are examining an extended trip he was able to make to Russia last year, even though Moscow asked the FBI to investigate him. They said Tsarnaev's name apparently was misspelled on a travel document. But according to Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, her agency was still aware of Tsarnaev's trip, a comment that raised new questions by at least one prominent Republican on a Senate panel today.
Napolitano says her agency knew of Tsarnaev's trip to Russia despite the error on his travel document.
Even with the misspelling, under our current system, there are redundancies. And so the system did ping when he was leaving the United States.
But Napolitano said by the time Tsarnaev returned to the U.S. last summer, an FBI alert on him had expired, so his reentry was not noted. GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, though, says the FBI has told him it did not even know that Tsarnaev had left for Russia.
After having talked to the FBI, they told me they had no knowledge of him leaving or coming back.
Tsarnaev's trip to Russia is a focus of investigators who are trying to understand his behavior and possible motives. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
The Mississippi man accused of mailing poison letters to President Obama and others has been released from jail. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports Paul Kevin Curtis's release comes as his preliminary and detention hearing was cut short today.
The U.S. Marshals Service in Oxford says Curtis has been released from federal custody. He was arrested last week for sending ricin-tainted letters to President Obama, Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker, and a North Mississippi judge. A preliminary and detention hearing was canceled today after prosecutors and defense lawyers conferred with the judge. They're expected to provide an update on the case later. Monday, an FBI agent testified that searches of Curtis's vehicle and house found no traces of the poison. The letters were signed, "I am KC and I approve this message," a phrase Curtis, an Elvis impersonator, had used on his Facebook page. His lawyer, Christy McCoy, says there's no physical evidence linking Curtis to the letters, and someone may have framed him. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Dow is up 133 points at 14,700. This is NPR. A Dutch court has sentenced a diplomat to 12 years in prison for giving confidential NATO and European Union documents to Russian agents. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson reports from Berlin that the case is linked to that of a Russian couple on trial in Germany on similar charges.
The Hague District Court ruled that Raymond Poterij had damaged the interests of the Dutch state and its allies by passing on sensitive military and political documents to Russian agents. He worked for the Dutch Foreign Affairs Ministry and had served in several Dutch embassies. The court said the diplomat earned at least $94,000 for information on the civil war in Libya, EU fact-finding missions in Georgia, and Dutch peacekeeping missions in Kosovo and Afghanistan. The diplomat was arrested last year after a German investigation uncovered the Russian couple that had hired him. The Russian pair is currently on trial over what's being called the biggest spy scandal in Germany since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Berlin.
New homes in the U.S. have been selling at their fastest pace in 3 years. The Commerce Department posted a 1.5% increase in March. Bob Breska, chief economist with Fact and Opinion Economics, expresses cautious optimism.
It's good news to see that. We have a bounce back from a decline in February. But, you know, these numbers can be somewhat erratic. I mean, the last 3 months, you've got January up 14% and February down 7%, now up 1.5%.
New home sales reached a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 417,000 last month. That is still far below the level suggesting a healthy housing market. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Zurich Insurance, sponsor of the Zurich Classic Golf Tournament in New Orleans, April 25th through April 28th.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up your Shakespeare, and the women you will wow. If you can't be a Hammond to Hamlet, they will not give a damn or a damlet.
Just recite an occasional sonnet, and your lap will have honey.
For all you English majors on the Bard's birthday, it's The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Being your own boss, it's a pretty good fantasy for a lot of people. Far fewer, though, have personalities that sync with the real pressures, even if they're not starting a business from scratch. Now the incentive to buy a business may face another reality. A bill in conference today would compel a new owner to maintain the old workforce in businesses with at least 100 employees, a growing concern for anyone looking to buy or sell a going concern. Matt DiGeronimo brokers deals between buyers and sellers, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
On the face of this, looking at it, one of the first questions is this constitutional? I mean, can we tell someone buying a business, you've got to keep that workforce?
I don't think there's anything in the Constitution that talks about the right of an individual to own property. Is there? Do we recognize property rights either in the state or the nation?
You're asking that as a rhetorical question.
Absolutely. I mean, the point is, of course. I mean, it's unconstitutional. It's laughable, and at best, it's just sort of cute. You know, at best, it's like an adorable little project that our seventh grader came to us and says, "Hey, wouldn't this be great to save jobs in the state?" But it's unconstitutional. It's laughable. It's unenforceable, and furthermore, it's written in such a way that it begets more questions than we would have time to address in this segment.
And one of them specifically would be, if we can say this is so for businesses with 100 employees, why not 5? Why not 15? Why not 30?
Well, right. And that's the big concern, because there's going to be a handful of people out there that say, well, wait a minute, we're not really talking about a, quote, small business. And in Hawaii, businesses with greater than 100 employees account for only about 4% of all businesses. But that's not at all germane. It's not, has nothing, you know, I think that this needs to be looked at the value of it from the perspective of what does it mean to own a business, and what role does the government play in enforcing what can and cannot be done with that personal property.
No one likes the idea of having a new owner come in and summarily dismiss people who are on staff, make major changes, disrupt lives and livelihoods, all of that. Clearly, the intent behind this is to keep that disruption from happening. But the question you're asking is, at what cost? And forgetting the constitutional issue for a second, really, what does that say about ownership? Can you really own a business if you have government telling you what you can do or not do when you buy that business and see perhaps it needs to have changes made to it and you're hamstrung?
That's right. And it's certainly a step in the direction of saying, no, you don't have that business, and no, that business is not a tool that you in the free market can use to generate profits. In fact, that is an instrument of the government for creation and the security of jobs, which is completely at odds with the right of property ownership. So that in and of itself is a very disturbing, it's disturbing that it's even being discussed. Unfortunately, like a lot of well-intended but misinformed efforts, if it passed, let's just say it passed, in addition to this philosophical discussion that we're having, it will actually result in the loss of more jobs because it passed.
Why?
Well, if someone is looking at buying a business and they know that this particular law is on the books, that becomes an element in their decision process about whether to buy or not buy that business.
So you're saying it's obviously disincentivizing someone from buying it, but how does that result in the loss of those jobs?
Well, what happens if the business, so the only circumstance under which a new owner would come in and just summarily dismiss employees would be in a distressed business where they're trying to save the business. Profitably operating businesses don't see the new owners come in and fire everyone. That just doesn't happen. So in a distressed sale, if they were not allowed to do that and the business does not sell to somebody that can fix it, then the business will just go under.
So those people would lose their jobs anyway, is your point?
Absolutely.
So how is it that we can even be talking about this at this point? Because no other place in the country has a bill like this. And there are those people like you who say, yeah, for good reason, and these are the reasons. How did it get this far?
How much time do we have? Because we were talking a little bit before the show. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that some of these, we make an assumption that our legislators will use the time they have in session to make their constituents' lives better. But in fact, I think the opposite is true, in that this in session time is being used to for more political pandering than anything else. And if I can say, I supported a bill that was going to save jobs, sometimes the conversation ends there.
We've already heard from the Tax Foundation of Hawaii, Chamber of Commerce, several different islands, business organizations, retail merchants. Obviously, business doesn't like this and labor does. That's not an unknown position given what we've seen in the past. But looking at this one in particular, do you at all feel that somehow there is an understanding that labor isn't having about this particular bill that maybe it should?
Well, I think that I think there needs to be a bridging of the gap between those that support, quote, labor and those that support business. Because from my perspective, the incentives for both are actually much more similar than we realize. And the gap is more of a political gap than a gap that is anyway based in facts. And so I think that, you know, at some point, I think labor has to say, look, we get what's going on here, but you're no longer benefiting those who
that they're hoping to protect, particularly if you're talking about people who are involved in a business that's tanking.
That's right.
All right. Well, we're not going to have long to wait to see what happens with this today.
I am very hopeful that this is just a bill that's going to come and go and that we won't see it on the books. But
we may see it in Gridiron later in the year. Thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Matt DiGeronimo is the Senior Managing Director of Smith Floyd Mergers and Acquisitions. He also hosts the firm's weekly radio show on KGU AM. HB 634, the bill to compel a new owner to keep existing employees in businesses with over 100 staffers, at least as it's written now. It's in conference today, and the link is on our website.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. Later in the show, women reporting conflict, lawmakers apportioning money, and now, your quiz.
In the backyard today, we're going southwest of West Molokai to find another Hawaiian volcano that's not easy to see unless you're looking down, especially from the back of a fishing boat. This rich fishing spot is not an island anymore since it was last above sea level close to 500,000 years ago. And geologists still debate whether or not it was part of East Oahu, West Molokai, or completely independent. However, it did build from the ocean floor from the same hot spot that fuels the Big Island's active volcanoes, reaching more than 15,000 feet by the time it broke the surface. Around 1.2 million years ago, it was the western peninsula of the largest Hawaiian island ever, Maui Nui, which covered about 6,200 square miles, half again as large as present-day Hawaii Island. Well, anyway, since it subsided beneath the waves hundreds of thousands of years before the Hawaiians got here, it never did receive a proper Hawaiian name. And today, we call this submerged volcano Penguin Bank. Question is, why? We'll waddle back with the answer later in the show.
Hey, good morning. My name is Jeff Gear, and I'm here to tell you some spooks. A little bit of story. Yeah, so here's a scoop. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2. Find out more about the show by going to hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. Got it?
Journalists in war zones have always been beleaguered, and their tough life is not getting any easier. We hear again and again of journalists becoming targets in some of the most dangerous places on Earth. Women face a special challenge in covering the news because so many of the world's trouble spots are places where the idea of a strong, independent career woman is an implicit challenge to the fabric of their society. Kim Barker is a journalist who has seen more than her share of conflict around the globe and has dealt with attitudes toward women sharply at odds with the job she has to do. She feels strongly that news coverage by women is a necessity, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're pretty comfortable in parts of the world that are considered trouble spots. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, sure. Definitely.
How did you get that way?
I guess I got that way by doing it and actually going to the places, and specifically Pakistan and Afghanistan. I went to those countries actually before I ever even visited Europe. So it was almost like I grew up in a way with international travel and going to places that were very foreign. And I still feel very much at home there.
Was it strange at first? I mean, was this was there some learning involved in getting to where you are now?
I mean, sure, most definitely.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know much about Islam when I first went there, and that would have been in January of 2002. I didn't know much about the culture. I can say now, pretty ignorant. What I knew how to do was to tell stories and how to tell stories about people. And also how to learn on the ground, which I think are the skills of any journalist. So that's what I did there. I got there. I immediately made a number of mistakes, such as ordering sushi from room service in Islamabad, which if anybody's planning to go there, is most definitely a
mistake. Take that off your list.
Yeah, exactly. The first time I went to Afghanistan. Was January of 2002. I got off the plane, realized I had forgot my money, and asked somebody where the nearest cash station was. turns out there are not ATMs in a war zone.
Who knew?
Well, I did at that point.
Yeah, I mean, so... But you learn the way you learn everything.
Yeah, you learn on the ground. You learn by actually doing it. I am completely comfortable with talking about all the mistakes I made early on, because I think that, you know, it's a side of reporting maybe that doesn't necessarily get shown, because a lot of journalists write memoirs about, you know, how they were the only person in the room that knew everything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very easy to do that in retrospect, and it's not necessarily always true.
And it's also, you know, you don't learn journalism any other way than by doing it, no matter what you learn in, a, in a J school, right?
Right, 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 right.
I mean, just, I mean, it sounds to me as if your career has been just sort of, let me do my job where it is I'm doing my job, right?
Right. I think it's a little bit more shambolic than that. And, like, usually I end up in something that I didn't necessarily plan on.
But we're looking at it in retrospect.
Yeah, yeah. In retrospect, it's been a fabulous career.
Exactly. That's what I'm
saying. There
was
a plan from day one.
Yeah. But, you know, events overtake you, as they do any journalists, and you go along with them, and maybe it gets scary. I assume it has gotten scary once or twice in your career, or has it?
You know, it was interesting. I wrote a book about my time over there, which is sort of like a darkly comic book called The Taliban Shuffle, that covered the time between 2004 and 2009 in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And I would, in writing the Pakistan section of the book, that was the hardest part for me to write. And I ended up writing most of it whilst, you know, visiting my mother, because my mother lives in Arizona. She has no internet. She has no TV. Her idea of entertainment is talking about deep things to her daughter. So it was the perfect place for me to write, because it was really the only place I could avoid talking about deep things with my mother. So I wrote pretty much half the book visiting her. And I would write the Pakistan sections, and almost it was like just being around my mother gave me the courage to write through some of the things I had seen in Pakistan. And I would then read things out loud to her. What I had written in the morning, I would read to her in the afternoon, and she just, her mouth would be open, you know, and she would be shaking her head. She would be almost in tears because she thought, oh, this is so scary for my daughter. And
that
for
you
me,
went through that.
Yeah. And for me, I was, you know, we refer to it as being almost like frogs in boiling water. You have no idea that this is actually dangerous, because and that you're boiling, because everybody around you is doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. You're always pushing yourself to get the story. You start to get more and more slack about the idea of safety. You don't really see it as a major deal when there's a suicide bombing right outside your house. You just see it as, this is going to interfere with people coming to my going away party, which is kind of strange.
Well, you've come a long distance to get to that mindset,
because you
had to.
Yeah.
I mean, to do otherwise would have been to have been paralyzed at a critical point in the work you're trying to do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, you fall in love with these stories and these countries and these people, and the whole idea of being able to tell what next, and the whole idea of feeling like your entire life matters in a way it doesn't necessarily matter, being just a reporter back in the United States. You feel like, at least when I was over there, I felt like Afghanistan and Pakistan were the biggest stories in the world. It was very difficult to dissuade me from that opinion.
And that's what you want from a reporter in the field.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what you want. Even if it's not the biggest story in the world, you don't
But
want
I would
you...
argue with you, it was the biggest story.
Yeah. But no editor wants to talk to a reporter in the field and say, this story isn't that great, right?
Right,
what
right.
kind of reporter is that?
Right. But everything, it's about, like, you're reporting the stories all the time. You're going to dinner parties with people where you're talking about how, you know, the political situation, how could things change? What do you think is going to happen? Everything revolves around something that feels like a life and death issue, and it really feels like what you're doing matters. In a way, it doesn't necessarily matter covering city council meetings back in the States. It's very difficult to come off of that, you know, very difficult to come back.
Well, it takes you to a level of intensity in your life that few other things can match.
Right. Definitely.
I mean, you hear this from combat photographers, you know, war correspondents and people like that. It's just nothing else has that level of energy.
Right.
But you have to have a sense of mission. And I think you've clearly gotten that as a journalist about what it is you do. I mean, you're not waiting for somebody else to tell you it's important, is what it sounds like.
No, I mean, No, if you had to wait for that, you'd be sitting around waiting a pretty long time. Because there's always a way to rationalize not spending money, especially in journalism these days.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like it costs a lot to have reporters overseas. It costs a lot to deliver these stories. And with the economic crisis in journalism, you don't have nearly as much of this reporting going on. Or you've got it being done by freelancers who are putting themselves in danger to be able to make a name for themselves, which is also very dangerous.
Well, it's dangerous for the outcome of the story as opposed to for the freelancers because the level of detail just isn't the same, is it? Kim, we've got to go, but thanks so much for talking to us this morning. It was great talking with you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Kim Barker is speaking tonight at UH Manoa on From Montana to Afghanistan, Covering Conflict and the Clash of Cultures, this evening at 6 p.m., and details are on our HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Travasa Hana, an experiential resort with daily flights to Hana on Mokulele Airlines, celebrating Hawaii through adventure, culinary, culture, fitness, and spa programs. Travasa.com/Hana.
Activists report at least 100 dead, maybe many more, after 6 days of fighting near Damascus. Riots erupted in refugee camps over the border in Jordan, and American allies in Britain and France claim Syria has already used chemical weapons. I'm Jennifer Ludden. What's next in Syria? Has Assad's regime crossed a red line? Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
This program is brought to you with pride by Hawaii Public Radio's members, volunteers, and community partners. Special thanks to Hawaii Architecture Foundation, Foodscapes Hawaii, and Monkey Pod Kitchen at Ko'olina for their generous support of Challenge 2013. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. The Hawaii legislative session is just about a week away from its scheduled end, and lawmakers are getting down to deciding what they're actually willing to pay for. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for a look in today's reality check. Good morning.
Hey, Beth Ann, how are you?
Well, we're all now at this point where the conversation is turning to cash and
yes,
what's funded
yes.
and at what level is going to be what really truly characterizes this session. But we've gotten some clues from the money chairs. What specifically points to a real answer for you as to what you think will be funded this time around?
Well, I got to give credit to Nathan Eagle, our Civil Beat reporter that's been covering the budget. That included being there last night for a 7 p.m. conference committee hearing. There's another one tonight at 7 p.m. as well. But among the things that were agreed on last night by the House and Senate conferees, funding levels for education, information technology initiatives, IT, that's something the governor has pushed for. They're dealing with the sequestration, the federal budget cuts, and taking care of some of those vacant positions that have been there for a long time, cutting them rather than keeping them in the budget. So progress being made on this roughly $24 billion budget over the next 2 years.
We still don't know exactly how much the governor is going to get for some of his education initiatives. So it seems that, you know, we've got an agreement in principle, but when it really comes down to how much we'll go into it and what we're willing to spend this year, especially given the fact that we have the big question mark of sequestration. And yes, there's been money put away for that, but not nearly at the level that the governor had wanted. It's still a little dicey.
That's correct. In terms of early childhood education, those initiatives, really, in many ways, the governor's biggest goal this year. And we don't know what the dollar amounts are going to be there. I mean, the way they do this is they do it one initiative at a time, filling one puka here, one puka there. One of the pukas they did fill is agreeing to $60 million over each of the next 2 years. I mentioned this IT initiative. You know, the governor's office, the administration, not their fault, but some of those computers they're almost like using Wangs. That's how antiquated this system is. And so remember Wang computers way back in the day? So that's something that the governor has to be happy about. And he mentioned sequestration. Initially, they had set aside $25 million to deal with those federal budget cuts. Now it's been cut back down to $15 million. The concern is that not that many states are really doing anything about it. So maybe it's not as serious a concern. The House and Senate, however, are going to form a committee to track the impact of sequestration.
Or maybe we just slipped on a pair of rosy glasses and we're not going to worry about it. Smart or not a good idea? Are we really looking at the right things this time around?
I think the big question hanging over everything right now is the public sector contract agreements. They did agree for $107 million for the UPW, United Public Workers. You still have HSTA and HGEA. You got to work that out. In many ways, that overrides everything because the agreements are higher than was expected. It does appear, however, there is money in the budget to accommodate that.
Well, we don't have a long time to go until we can look back and say that we can formally understand what this session was truly all about. All the conversation aside, what's going to get the cash is going to define how we really are moving forward. Thanks, Chad.
Sure, Beth Ann. Talk to you tomorrow.
You bet. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. I'm Chris Vandercook. After the news, a medical perspective on organ donation, scenes from a comedian's life, and the answer to the backyard quiz. Now here's a look at global events from Al Jazeera.
Hello, I'm Fawzia Ibrahim, and these are the stories making headlines on Al Jazeera. In Iraq, at least 20 people have been killed in a demonstration near Kirkuk. Security forces broke up a protest against the Shia-led government 30 miles out of the city. The education minister, who had been talking to the protesters, has also resigned. It's the latest in a series of demonstrations by Sunni Muslims against the Shia-led government. France has condemned an attack on its embassy in Libya. Two security guards were wounded in the car bombing in the capital, Tripoli. The French foreign minister says there could have been many victims, but the blast happened before most of the embassy's employees had arrived at work.
The force of the explosion brought down the walls of nearby buildings and started a fire that engulfed some offices inside the embassy. One French security officer was seriously wounded, another suffered light injuries. The government has condemned the attack and promised to track down the perpetrators.
It's an attack that is aimed at not only France, but all the countries who are fighting against terrorist groups. I'm going to Libya immediately, as discussed with the President and Prime Minister. I will go there to see the guards, and after that we have a meeting with the Libyan government. The Foreign Minister called me this morning to say he was completely at our service.
Last September, the U.S. consulate in Benghazi in eastern Libya was attacked. U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed. Also in Benghazi last year, a convoy carrying the British ambassador was hit by a rocket. No one was seriously injured. The French embassy bombing is the first such serious attack in Tripoli, where security is generally seen as better.
These targeted attacks, and the attacks, if you noticed, they are on those countries that helped Libya, namely the American ambassador, before that was the British, and now the French. And one can draw only one conclusion, that those who are opposing the revolution, who are opposing the change in Libya, are targeting the very people who helped Libyans to realize their dream. That's democracy and freedom.
2 years after the ousting of Muammar Gaddafi, Libya is awash with weapons. There are militias over which the government has no control. Jackie Rowland, Al Jazeera, Paris.
Now, Japan says that it will use force to expel any Chinese ships that land on disputed islands in the East China Sea. It made the announcement as 8 Chinese vessels entered the area. Rob McBride has more.
Both sides have now shown their willingness to assert their claims with equal vigor. The danger is, in all of these shows of force, that an accidental collision or even fatality takes place that would take this dispute to a far more serious level.
Two prominent Syrian bishops have reportedly been kidnapped. State media say rebel fighters in the north abducted the leaders of the Syriac and Greek Orthodox churches. Christians make up less than 10% of Syria's population, and many have sided with the Assad government because it guarantees religious freedom. And you can find the latest on all those stories and much more at aljazeera.com.
What would you do if someone in your immediate family suddenly died and you were faced with the choice of organ donation? Your answer might already be made by the decision your family member recorded in personal legal papers or a designation on a driver's license, or it just might be left up to you. None of this is easy to consider, yet for patients hovering between death and the hope of a second chance at life, that hope comes at a price. This month is Donate Life Month. Registered nurse Felicia Wells-Williams runs the Family Services Program at Legacy of Life Hawaii, and she joins us now. This is a really difficult conversation to have, even talking about it in the abstract, because there's such a human cost to this.
Absolutely. And what we know and what we hear families tell us is the amazing comfort that donation can bring to them in the days and months after they've lost a loved one. And that's really what is the passion and the inspiration for all of us at Legacy of Life Hawaii, understanding that donation can be a comfort to donor families.
In a way, it's trying to take death and turn it back into life, but you can't minimize the fact that death has caused what might be a second chance for someone else. So it's a case of perhaps even, if you win and you find that organ, you still lose because you still feel the loss of what caused it.
And many recipients do feel that. You know, we share letters between donor families and recipients. We do that confidentially. But when recipients write, you can often hear in the voice of their letter that sense that they have of somewhat of a guilt. You know, they have survived. They've been given the second chance, and yet they know that another family is grieving, and they are alive because of that.
It's a different form of survivor's guilt.
Absolutely.
Last year, when we took a look at this, we still had about 400 people or so on the waiting list, people who are at end-stage organ failure. Is that still consistent?
That is correct. Approximately 400 people in Hawaii are waiting now for life-saving organs and tissues.
And what about the ability to actually find organs and tissue for them? That's been escalating in ways that not necessarily keeping pace?
Actually, we have seen quite a rise in donations in Hawaii. Last year at Legacy of Life Hawaii, we had both record numbers in organ donors and tissue donors. It seems that families in Hawaii are truly beginning to consider the option of donation. It is becoming more commonplace conversation, and we're definitely seeing a rise in donor designations where individuals are making that decision themselves and putting it on their driver's license or in their other legal health documents.
That's a long way from where we were when we first started to have these conversations about what was really necessary and how this could happen. And plus, we've had in the last couple of years the transplant center close and Queens taking on part of it and phasing in other parts of it. So now in Hawaii, we're still doing kidney and liver. Correct.
Yes, we are. We have a kidney transplant program and a liver transplant program. I believe the pancreas program is soon to reopen, and I don't know about a heart program. That was something that even had closed at St. Francis or at Hawaii Medical Center prior to the closing of the transplant center.
So if you're talking about pulmonary transplants for heart or lungs, that's really something that's going to happen on the mainland.
Yes, it does. And we can recover lungs for transplant in Hawaii and have successfully done so. Those lungs have been sent to the mainland for transplant.
Into someone from Hawaii?
We have had that. That's a very extraordinary circumstance in which lungs were recovered at one of the Honolulu hospitals. They were transported very quickly to the mainland and transplanted into a gentleman from Hilo. It was quite an extraordinary story for both families, the family of the donor and the family of the recipient.
Because we're often told that, you know, if you want to up your chances, your better shot is to go to the mainland and wait there. So in this case, it worked.
Well, this gentleman had to go to the mainland because we don't have a local lung transplant program, so his only option for a transplant was to go. But we do encourage patients in Hawaii who need kidneys and livers to be registered locally, because we are having a program to meet those needs. But heart transplant and lung transplant does require patients to travel to the mainland.
You're a registered nurse, and you've had a career in nursing that was before your career with Legacy Now, but Legacy of Life. But there is this question, and it's a sensitive one, about ethical considerations and weighing what the best and highest cause can be fulfilled by having someone who may be losing his life or her life, and what might happen with that person's organs. There is somewhat of a myth, I'll call it a myth for the moment, that somehow when a doctor or a nurse knows that there's not such a good chance that a person may survive, that maybe they might not try as hard. Can you speak to that for a little bit? That's very, you know, very uncomfortable for a lot of people to stop and consider, even if they're thinking about becoming a donor.
I know that that is a myth that exists, and many people will not designate themselves as donors because they're afraid that when something happens to them, that they won't get quality care, that they won't, their life won't be saved. And really, nothing could be further from the truth. The EMTs, the physicians, and the nurses that are lifesavers, that are working hard to care for our loved ones in the hospital, are not focused on donation and that outcome of transplant. It is only after all efforts have been made to save someone's life, and that life cannot be saved, that donation even enters into the realm of possibility.
So the bottom line of it is that when all of those options have been exhausted and this person has no chance of recovery, that's when you start to think about it. But then time becomes very critical, because you have to be able to harvest those organs and get them to the patient who's waiting. How do you begin a conversation with a family who's just been told that they've lost their loved one, especially when they've come into the hospital with the hope that somehow that person would be saved?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think if the community really understood the care and concern that goes into that conversation, it might lessen some of the fears that people have about donation. And we certainly want to respect every family culturally, religiously, and really understanding the circumstances that resulted in this death, so that we can offer that family support, comfort. We want to provide crisis intervention, allow a family to stabilize so that they can really fully consider the option that is before them. And even in cases in which the donation decision has already been made, we still enter into that conversation with a family with that same sensitivity, care, and compassion, because we want every family's experience with donation to be positive. And even when a loved one has made a decision, the shock for a family at the loss, the shock that their loved one had made that decision, may cause some trauma for the family. So we want to enter into those conversations very sensitively.
Because
carefully.
In some cases, families don't know that that person has made a decision already. So one of the takeaways from this is, if that's your decision, let people know.
It's
because
a gift.
Nobody plans. Nobody plans on having an accident. Nobody plans that something should happen. But to have a plan in the event of, it's still something that we talk more and more about these days.
Yes,
thank
and
you
it's
for
a gift.
Coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Felicia Wells-Williams is a registered nurse and the Family Services Director of Legacy of Life Hawaii. She and the program's social workers and chaplain help family members of potential organ and tissue donors make informed decisions about donation. More information to start a conversation of your own is on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
the show, we asked you why Penguin Bank has never had a proper Hawaiian name. About 1.2 million years ago, Penguin Bank Volcano was the westernmost peninsula of the largest Hawaiian island ever, Maui Nui, and it rose to about a maximum of 500 feet above sea level and was over 20 miles long. Today, its highest elevation is about 30 feet below sea level, and it averages between 1 to 200 feet down, forming a deep-sea fisherman's paradise between Oahu and Molokai. Now, since it sank hundreds of thousands of years before the ancient Hawaiians got here, it never did receive a proper Hawaiian name. So we asked you, why is it called Penguin Bank? No penguins anywhere near it. Well, here's what happened. On July 20th, 1897, a British survey ship was taking soundings in the Molokai Channel for an undersea telegraph cable to connect Canada and Australia, and blimey, the water got real shallow. And the name of the ship? Why, the HMS Penguin, of course. If you have a penguin, if you have a backyard quiz idea, penguin or otherwise, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Karen Weichert from Moahine Media. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear in the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
No one's life is a fairy tale, and the lives of celebrated people are often filled with the kind of pain that can either inspire or destroy. In the life of actress and comedian Carol Burnett, early struggles acted as a source of driving career ambition and provided her with the bittersweet ingredients of comedy. Juliana Scheinhorst plays Carol Burnett in the play Hollywood Arms, which looks at three generations of women living on welfare, one of them on the cusp of stardom. It's a Maui onstage production, and Juliana joins us by phone. Good morning, Juliana. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
Pretty good. This is a point in Carol Burnett's life, at the point at which we meet her in the play, when she hasn't had her success yet, right?
No. The beginning of Act Two is when I come in, so it's 10 years later. We have a really talented actress, Marley, who plays a childhood Carol Burnett. And so when I come on stage, I'm still struggling. I'm starting at UCLA. I'm working at the movie theater. And then from me working from the movie theater, I have to perform on stage and reenact the movie when the projector breaks. And so at that moment, I sing I'm Always Chasing Rainbows. And that's when the real kind of Carol Burnett in me kind of comes out. And I realize that I want to go to Broadway and be an actress and perform for the rest of my life.
So you really have a moment of discovery enacted there on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
It's really, really great. Like, I have to reenact this whole movie scene, and there's different voices, and I've watched so much Carol Burnett, it's ridiculous. So hopefully I picked up some of her mannerisms. Like, I cross my eyes a lot, and I flail my limbs a lot, and it's really fun.
Part of her, you know, her whole effect, her whole magic was being very unselfconscious. She's not trying to be pretty or glamorous all the time, is she?
No, not at all. So I picked up on that very well.
Well, good. You also, you find when you often read the biographies of funny people, and they have a lot of aspects in their lives that aren't that funny, right? Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Where do you think comedy comes from in somebody like Carol?
Well, my castmates and I were actually just talking about it, and I was reading one of her biographies when I first got the part, and I don't know if I'm going to quote this right, but it was like, without tragedy, nothing funny can happen, or something along those lines. And so I think to compensate for all the hurt and pain in your life, like, there has to be some joy. And so I guess she didn't want others to feel that way, and she didn't want to feel that way anymore. So she brought this joy and divine humor to herself and her life and the people around her.
Well, it kind of becomes an effort of will, doesn't it, Juliana? I mean, you can either, this could destroy me, or it could be something I could use, right?
Definitely.
Well, how do you convey that, you know? What becomes then your job as the actor portraying that? What are the things you concentrate on?
Well, it's actually been a really difficult role because Carol Burnett is hysterical, so I have to bring that kind of Carol Burnett, the one that everyone knows from the Carol Burnett Show, and be funny. But then I also have to channel this really emotional kind of struggling character who's living on welfare, and she has to deal with her mom, and then she has to deal with her grandmother, and then the second act she has a little sister that she's basically responsible for, and then she's growing up with kind of really a broken family life, so then I also have to channel that energy while also still trying to be funny and bring the Carol Burnett character that everyone knows. I think that's been the biggest struggle, is trying to go back and forth.
Well, I would think so, because you're really at two extremes, and yet, you know, if successful, you're going to help people understand that whole link between the sad and the funny, I would think.
I hope so.
Well, I mean, the material is certainly there in the play to get you started, don't you mm-hmm. think? I mean, do you feel that the play really kind of helps people go to that place, understand that?
Oh, I think it's a beautifully written play, and our director, Michael, has been so good at just getting the perfect portrayal of it. He knows exactly what he wants. His vision is great. He's very understanding about us. Like, especially, I was really struggling with trying to go back and forth, and he just knew what to say. And now our show is beautiful, and the dialogue is beautiful, and all the performances are really heartfelt and really to the core. And I think it's gonna make the audience cry at points. I know. I'm kind of excited just to see how hard have everyone see how hard we've worked and how much emotion we put into these characters.
What kind of emotional cross currents is the young Carol Burnett getting from her mother and grandmother as you meet her in the play?
So when you meet her at the point where I come into the play, we see that her mother Louise kind of going off the deep end. She's kind of struggling with trying to find herself, because she moved out to Hollywood in the first place to become a famous writer.
Oh, boy.
So she's obviously, in that time, it was kind of the time of the Depression when it was in her childhood, so she's really struggling. So then her grandmother, Nanny, as she's called in the play, is still, she's really lovable, but she's really almost neurotic, because she's really trying to take care of Helen, and then we have her younger sister, now Alice, in the second act where I come in. And then we have Alice, and she's just really sassy because she's going through the same thing that Carol Burnett's character went through in the first act, but she's kind of taking it the more rebellious side. So, and then my character, Helen, or like Carol Burnett, is trying to like pick up the pieces and hold the family together that's pretty much falling apart.
It sounds as if there's that Carol at that stage had a lot of pressures on her from her mother's
definitely.
Thwarted ambition. Does the mother sort of live a little bit through her daughter at that point?
At that point, she's gone off the deep end, so she kind of, she just doesn't really have the willpower to do anything really anymore. So that's why Helen has to step in and almost be the mother for her little sister, Alice, and like help provide for the family and the rent, and while she's all paying for school and then hoping to go to Broadway, so...
You know, you make it sound as if for your character, getting on stage and reenacting all the different characters in a movie would almost be a kind of release from what she's leaving behind at home.
For sure, because the character, she doesn't really get a lot of attention at home, and she can't really be herself because she has to put on this mature kind of, I have to be the adult here and help everybody.
That really
so
helps you.
One scene in the play where I have to reenact the movie, and it's a really lighthearted and it's super fun to play, and I do a bunch of different voices, so I feel at that point, that's like I feel Carol's kind of like released, like finally I get to be myself and I get to be funny for one time.
It sounds that way. Juliana, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Juliana Scharnhorst plays Carol Burnett in the Maui On Stage production of Hollywood Arms. The show runs weekends through May 5th at the historic Iao Theater, and you can learn more from our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
And after I'm gone, a lot of things will happen, a lot of things will happen, oh Lord, amen. Yes, after I'm gone, A lot of things will happen that I won't know about then. So it's the meantime, meantime. All they gave me is that in-between time for my loving and my living. Gotta do it in the time.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honua Kai Resort and Spa, with studios, 1, 2, and 3-bedroom suites on Maui, dedicated to creating a place for kama'aina who enjoy traveling together. HonuaKaiMaui.com.
We just heard a little snippet of a song that Carol Burnett did talking about the meantime. Really, that's all any of us really gets is, you know, what happens between the time that we get here and the time that we make an exit. But not just in the world of comedy. She has made such a difference in so many other ways. I'm thinking about the fund that she started at UH for responsible journalism. Cross currents in her life, and certainly here in Hawaii where she once made a home. Good to end the day.
Well, she obviously went way beyond comedy, but the comedy was rooted in humanity, and I think that's what gives it its depth in the first place, you know, that. And it sounds as if this play gives a lot of insight into the origins of that comedy, because comedy, as many have said in different ways, comes from trouble. It doesn't come from a placid, quote, normal life. It comes from disturbance, uproar, and upheaval. And, you know, she found a way to be liberated through it. And then when she benefited from that in her career, she benefited others. It's a pretty good paradigm to follow.
Much better than some of the self-help books.
One would think, yes.
Well, that's going to do it for us today. Coming up, though, tomorrow, we're going to take a look at what Kauai Police Chief Daryl Perry says. He wants a clean, transparent department with a special division for finding bad cops. We'll talk with him about how he expects to make it happen.
Plus, from one frustration to another, a Hawaii Island farmer turned filmmaker on a subject close to his heart.
If you want to hear a past show or get links to more information, check out the archive on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. And yeah, this show will be there too in about 15 minutes.
Meanwhile, talk back to your radio. Sound off about anything you hear on the show at Hawaii Conversation on Facebook, or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BecauseHPR. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back here to meet up with you for more conversation tomorrow morning. Have a good day.